Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode. Welcome to the Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar. The Morningstar Investment Conference for investment professionals will be held virtually this year on September 16th and 17th. We're offering the same research, analysis, and insight for investment professionals you'd get at the live event for a reduced price of $149. And the best part is, you can join us from wherever you are. For more information or to register, visit go.morningstar.com/MIC. Again, that website is go.morningstar.com/MIC. In this week's podcast, Alex Bryan tells investors how to bolster their portfolios when the dollar declines. David Blanchett explains how investors can estimate the length of their retirements. We shine a light on two overlooked stocks, and we share the Widemoat name that three of our favorite managers invested in. Let's get started. Christine Benz from Morningstar Inc. interviews Alex Bryan from Morningstar Research Services.
Hi, I'm Christine Benz from Morningstar.com. The dollar has recently slid relative to other major foreign currencies. Joining me to discuss the potential implications for investors' portfolios is Alex Bryan. He's Morningstar's Director of Passive Strategies Research in North America. Alex, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Alex, let's discuss why this is happening. We have seen the dollar decline relative to other foreign currencies, and lots of factors can influence that. But what are your thoughts about what's driving the dollar down?
Yeah, so I think a big part of it is what's happening with interest rates in the U.S. right now. So the Fed aggressively cut interest rates earlier this year in response to the coronavirus pandemic, which has really ravaged the economy and significantly increased unemployment. And I think there's an expectation that interest rates will remain low for some time, particularly as the Fed strives to increase inflation expectations and boost employment. Fed Chairman Powell recently announced a shift in the Fed's monetary policy framework, where it is adopting an average inflation targeting approach. In this new framework, the Fed will allow inflation to run above its long-term 2% target, following periods when it's been below that threshold before raising rates. So I think there's an expectation that interest rates will remain low for a long period of time, and that inflation might be higher in the years to come than it has been in the past. And I think both of those things can cause the dollar to continue to be weak relative to foreign currencies.
Okay, so let's discuss how this affects various asset classes. If I have equity funds in my portfolio, what are the implications of a falling dollar?
So it really depends on the company. A weak dollar should help U.S. companies that generate a larger share of their revenues outside the U.S. because that translates back into more profits in U.S. dollars. So if you think about the types of U.S. companies that have more exposure to the foreign markets, they tend to be larger firms, and you tend to find them more on the growth side of the style box. So a lot of tech companies, consumer product companies like Apple, tend to generate more of the revenue overseas. So those types of stocks should do better in this type of environment. We would also expect some sector effects. So firms that are operating in the material sector, industrial sector, consumer product sector should also tend to do a little bit better from a weaker dollar because, again, they're translating their foreign revenues back to the U.S. at a more favorable rate.
And how about foreign stock holdings? How are they affected by the dollar's decline?
So for an unhedged foreign stock fund, the biggest effect will come directly from the currency movements, where when you own a foreign stock fund, you effectively are owning stocks that are denominated in different currencies. So as the dollar becomes weaker, those stocks become worth more in U.S. dollars. So you actually have a direct bet against the U.S. dollar baked into unhedged foreign stock funds. So those should actually benefit from a weaker dollar.
Okay. So we've had this long running headwind for foreign stock funds that are unhedged. It appears to, at least in the short term, reversed a little bit.
That's right.
Okay. So let's discuss bonds, how they're impacted by changes in the dollar's value.
Yeah, so with foreign, and I think the effect really is more on the foreign bond funds where you see the currency impact come in. But if you look at an unhedged foreign bond fund, most of the volatility from those funds actually comes from currency fluctuations. Effectively, an unhedged foreign bond fund is a bet against the US dollar. And that's the main driver of those returns, particularly in the short term. So if you are owning one of those funds that's unhedged, those will actually benefit quite nicely from a declining dollar. Now, changing exchange rates also affect hedged, currency hedged foreign bond funds, but the effect is a bit more nuanced. So those funds, by hedging out their currency exposure, they reduce a lot of the volatility that currency fluctuations can introduce, but they're still susceptible to changes in forward exchange rates. So it doesn't eliminate the risk from currency entirely, but it certainly does smooth out the ride a bit. But I do think that investors who are looking primarily to diversify their bond holdings and don't necessarily want to make a bet for or against the US dollar, a hedged foreign bond fund would probably make more sense.
And that's because the volatility associated with the unhedged funds is just maybe too extreme for some fixed income investors, or what's your thinking?
Yeah, that's right. So if you leave your foreign currency exposure unhedged in a foreign bond fund, you're not really getting very clean exposure to the underlying bonds, because the underlying bonds really aren't driving the returns nearly as much as the currency fluctuations are. So that's it. Within foreign bond funds, currency fluctuations account for about 2/3 of the total volatility. For foreign stock funds, it's about 1/3 of the total volatility, again, because stocks are more volatile than bonds. But if you're looking just for that international bond exposure and you want to get cleaner exposure to those bonds, it makes sense to take out the part of the returns that are really volatile that have nothing to do with those foreign bonds.
So how should foreign currency fluctuations relative to the dollar, or vice versa, how should that influence how investors position their portfolios, if at all?
I think if you have a long enough time horizon and don't mind the volatility that comes along with currency fluctuations, there's really not a whole lot you need to do about it. I think you can just maintain a broadly diversified global portfolio and ride out those fluctuations, because over the long term, currency fluctuations tend to wash out. They tend to have very little impact on long-term returns. Now, they certainly do add to volatility in the interim. So if you are concerned about that, it might be worth considering a currency hedged fund for your international stock and bond exposure. Again, I think that the case for currency hedging is probably stronger on the bond side, just given that the currency fluctuations are a big part of where that risk comes from. But one fund that I really like for currency hedged exposure to foreign bonds is Vanguard Total International Bond ETF, ticker BNDX. This fund provides broad market value weighted exposure to investment grade bonds outside the US, and then it uses currency forwards to hedge its currency risk. So that helps tamp down on the volatility that would otherwise come from those currency fluctuations.
And how about for hedged foreign stock exposure? Any recommendations there?
Yeah, so one fund that I really liked for hedged stock exposure is Xtrackers MSCI EAFE Hedged Equity ETF. Ticker is DBEF. This fund basically targets stocks that are listed in foreign developed markets, weights them based on market capitalization, and then uses currency forward contracts to hedge out the currency risk. So that again helps smooth out some of the volatility that would otherwise come from those currency fluctuations. But otherwise, it's a very broadly diversified portfolio that effectively captures the composition of foreign developed stock markets. So I think that's a really good option to consider. It is a little bit more expensive than some of the non-currency hedged options, but it will be less risky. So if you are more risk averse, that might be an option worth considering.
Okay, Alex, important topic. Thank you so much for being here to share your insights.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for watching. I'm Christine Benz for Morningstar.com.
6 days a week, we deliver the latest news for investors. Just say, Alexa, enable the Morningstar skill, or visit Morningstar.com/Alexa. Now, David Blanchett from Morningstar Investment Management explains how investors can estimate the length of their retirements.
Hi, I'm Christine Benz for Morningstar. How well do people do at estimating the lengths of their retirement, and how can they do better? Joining me to discuss some research on that topic is David Blanchett. He's head of retirement research for Morningstar Investment Management. David, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, David, let's just talk about why it's so mission critical when you're creating a retirement plan to have some sense of how long your retirement will be. Why is that such an important number?
Well, I mean, the length of retirement really defines its cost, right? So if you have to live in 10 years in retirement versus 40, the estimate is very different. And I did some research that came out last year all about, you know, how to estimate when retirement is going to start. And so the new research is focused on the end of retirement, figuring out, you know, what really is an appropriate end date for retirement.
So how do people tend to do it this? How good are they at estimating? Essentially, what is their life expectancy?
So, you know, if you get 1,000 people together, the average estimate is pretty good. But at the individual level, there's huge deviations in the actual value. So, some fun statistics are there's actually, you know, a panel data set where they ask individuals, how long do you think you'll live? And then they track those individuals to see if they survived at the point in time. Those that said they had a 0% chance of surviving had about a 50% chance. And those that said 100% chance had about an 80% chance. And so people do get certain things right, like they do incorporate their health status. But, you know, looking at these estimates from probabilities or even just kind of point estimates makes me think, I don't want to ask someone how long they're going to live. I'd rather kind of have them take a questionnaire, online questionnaire, and use that number for a financial plan.
Let's talk about the implications if someone makes a faulty estimate of how long they'll live, if they assume that they will live, say, a shorter time than they are actually likely to live.
Well, again, you know, if you're setting a retirement period, whether it be 20 years or 40 years, and you're saving based upon that, you may over under save based upon what it ends up being. If you're in retirement, you may end up over under spending. And so I think that, you know, again, no one knows how long they're going to live, but there are things that are related to life expectancy, like income, health, smoker status, all these things. And I think that, you know, at least on the margin, we should think about those when, you know, doing a financial plan or just estimating how long to actually, you know, plan for in retirement.
How customized do financial planners tend to be when estimating clients' life expectancies? Your research took a look at that as well, or you made some inferences about that.
Yeah, I had information on about 30,000 financial plans, which is a pretty good number, but there's probably millions of them done every year. And one thing that I found that was interesting is about 97% of plans use a multiple of 5, so 90 or 95 or 100. And you know, about 70% used age 90 and about 20% used age 95. And while that's good, it doesn't suggest that it's a lot of personalization, right? I don't think that you know, planners that are at least using this software are asking questions to say, hey, I should use maybe age 87 for you and age 93 for you. They're just kind of using the same age for everyone. And I think that's going to lead to, you know, imprecise estimates about the cost of retirement.
Okay. So you mentioned that ideally someone would go through some kind of a questionnaire. What would be some of the key questions that would come up? You mentioned smoker status, health status, and so forth. What else should be in the mix when considering longevity?
So there's some incredibly complicated calculators out there, and there's some relatively simple ones. I think that anything that, you know, at least, you know, gets to health, you know, ideally gets to income, incorporates things like gender, you know, that's great. You know, you can ask 25 questions or you can ask 4, but I mean, to be honest, you know, the evidence that I saw suggests that a lot of planners don't actually use any questions. They don't deviate their client assumptions at all based upon their client, even health status.
So in your research, you came away with some guidelines that you think planners or individuals thinking about their own life expectancy can use. So let's talk about how single people might approach this as well as how married couples might approach this topic.
Sure. So when selecting the length of retirement, it's important to remember there's different levers that you can use to kind of affect the outcome, right? And you shouldn't really ever just use life expectancy. If you use life expectancy, there's a 50% chance you could live beyond the target period. So you've got to kind of add on a margin of safety. And so what I did in the analysis is say, okay, let's assume that you actually, you know, are going to use life expectancy from an online personalized tool. You're going to go get a good estimate for you. What should you tack on to kind of create a reasonable period? And what I found is that you should add on 5 years for a single individual, or you should add on 8 years to the longer of the two life expectancies for a joint couple. So if you both go out and fill out an online questionnaire and, you know, one person says they're going to live 22 years and one person says 20, you'd use 30. And kind of the net out of all of it was that, you know, a 30-year retirement period for a married couple age 65 is actually a pretty good starting place today, at least for most households.
And David, you've spent a lot of time with these various calculators. Are there any that you really like and that you'd recommend?
You know, there's a ton of them out there. The one that I used for the research is called the Longevity Illustrator. It's by the Society of Actuaries, and it only asks a few questions. It asks things like when you're going to retire, what is your health status, do you smoke? But for most people, that actually gets down to kind of the heart of the matter. And why I really like their calculator is because it shows you the probability of living to different ages, right? So again, life expectancy is that kind of 50-50 middle point. It doesn't tell you that there's a, you know, there's a 10% chance you could live to age 105, but the Longevity Illustrator tool does. And so to me, you know, tools that give you a kind of a more comprehensive perspective on how long you could possibly live, I think that's better than just saying, hey, that, you know, the odds are you'll live to 95 and with no additional information.
And that's a free tool. I used it last night after reading your paper. Okay, David, really interesting research. Thank you so much for being here.
Sure.
Thanks for watching. I'm Christine Benz for Morningstar.
Watch all the Morningstar content you love from your living room. Download the Morningstar Roku channel and get up-to-date independent insights on today's markets. Be comfortable. Be informed.
Next, we highlight two undervalued stocks in today's market.
By Morningstar's estimate, the market is overvalued today, but that doesn't mean bargains can't be found. Here are two undervalued ideas our analysts are excited about. The first is BioMarin Pharmaceutical. We think the market has overreacted to the delayed launch of the firm's hemophilia A gene therapy. We think data supports the drug's safety and efficacy, and we expect the drug to launch in 2022 rather than in 2020. In addition, the parent's orphan drug portfolio and strong late-stage pipeline continue to support a narrow economic moat rating. Lastly, BioMarin is far ahead of its competitors in developing a drug for treating achondroplasia, which has no approved treatments. We believe shares of Herc present opportunity too, as investors have overlooked its strength and industry tailwinds. As the third largest equipment rental company in North America, it should continue to take market share from local firms that dominate in many areas. Customers who understand the value of their time will appreciate the greater equipment availability, superior logistics, and robust customer-facing technology Herc offers, which smaller firms can't replicate. Despite the upheaval related to the pandemic, the North America rental industry remains strong as key customers have avoided lockdowns and are unaffected by the COVID-19 precautions.
And lastly, we share the stock that three of our favorite managers invested in.
Each quarter, we take a look at the recent transactions of some of the top money managers around today, who we call our ultimate stock pickers. Last quarter, one stock was a high conviction purchase for three of our favorite managers. What's considered a high conviction purchase? A high conviction purchase is one that makes a meaningful addition to a portfolio, as measured by the size of the purchase in relation to the size of the portfolio. The managers at Diamond Hill Large Cap, DHLAX, Jensen Quality Growth, JENSX, and Vanguard Dividend Growth Investor, VDIGX, all made meaningful purchases of Procter & Gamble last quarter. At Morningstar, we think Procter & Gamble has carved out a wide economic moat, and we think the moat is stable. We applaud the firm's decision several years ago to prune its brand mix and focus on high-returning opportunities, which has allowed it to nimbly respond to evolving customer trends. Morningstar Sector Director Aaron Lash, who follows the company, concedes that the firm's mix of essential, trusted items are being propped up by the pandemic, particularly its cleaning and health-related brands. But she thinks P&G should be resilient. While there's much to like about the company, we think the stock is overvalued today. It's trading about 25% above our fair value estimate.
That does it for this week's Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar. We hope you have enjoyed our program and we welcome your feedback. Please send your comments and questions to podcast@morningstar.com. From everyone here at Morningstar, thanks for listening. This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest, or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. The podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered tax advice. Please consult a tax and/or financial professional for advice specific to your individual circumstances. Morningstar Research Services, LLC is a subsidiary of Morningstar, Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analysis, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.